Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess. Welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers and electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it, hit play on your iPod, iPad, or any device that you have. Today we have a really special show. I truly have a special guest, my daughter, Chelsea Shinneman, and what we're going to do today is we're going to explore the results of her extremely interesting senior year school marketing research project at John Carroll University, where she got 218 attorneys from around the country at large law firms, generally, to share their views on document review projects. This is a hotbed issue with managed review and technology encroaching or adding value on review projects, depending on your perspective. It also adds, I'm proud to say, to the Shinneman family podcast libraries. We had my father on several years ago, bringing his former background as an accountant on the FASB board to give some advice to lawyers on how to use sampling and project management in e-discovery. So now Chelsea has to compete with Grandpa to see who can do a more interesting show. So good luck, Chelsea. On this special show, we've also added some outside perspective, including the most famous e-discovery father-son relationship is a bookend to Chelsea and I, who might, after the show, be the most famous father-daughter e-discovery relationship. We've got Ralph Losey, who's head of e-discovery with Jackson Lewis and well-known e-discovery blogger at the e-discovery team. Ralph's been a frequent guest on ESI Bytes as a good friend and also oversaw my fictitious argument with Martin Tully in the Seventh Circuit CLE program against forcing us to use predictive coding, which Herb Roiplat and Sean Byrne argued that they wanted to use predictive coding. I believe that's available now on the Seventh Circuit pilot program's website as a video. I'm sure that Ralph and I are going to add some predictive coding discussions to the survey. We've also have for the first time on ESI Bytes his son, Adam Losey, who's an e-discovery attorney with the national law firm of Foley & Gardner. He's also been active in promoting e-discovery to law students by self-funding some interesting web-based law student writing initiatives. As we'll no doubt hear at some point in this program, Adam is also quite the e-discovery entrepreneur. And actually, Adam, what is the website? Tell us just briefly about this side project, and maybe we'll do another show in the future.
Sure, yeah, it's called ITLEX, and the address is it-lex.org. And ITLEX is actually an entirely separate not-for-profit organization, and we do a couple things, one of which is sponsor a cash prize writing competition for law students at ABA-accredited law schools. So if you know any law students or if you are a law student and want to check it out, the deadline for our first writing competition is February 1st, but there'll be more after that if you happen to catch this after the fact.
Fantastic initiative, and I'd love to do a show on that at some point. And lastly, we've got my good friend, Barry Murphy, who's a co-founder and analyst with the eDiscovery Journal. They sponsored the student survey, and I also do some adjunct consulting work and writing with the eDiscovery Journal and predictive coding. Prior to eDiscovery Journal, Barry was director of product marketing at Mimosa Systems, a leading content archiving and eDiscovery software. He joined Mimosa after a successful stint as principal analyst for eDiscovery, records management, content archiving at Forrester Research. So, Barry, thanks for joining us here on the ESI Bytes.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, it should be a very informative podcast as we share some of this groundbreaking data on what eDiscovery lawyers really think about document review with both data and perspective of outside consultants and lawyers. So let's start the show. And before we start, Ralph, you mentioned your family lineage might cause Chelsea and me more competition in eDiscovery than I'd realize. Just how much deeper does the Losey family go in eDiscovery?
Yeah, very funny. Well, first of all, glad to be here. It's great to have a day after Christmas family event as we're recording it on the 26th of December. And Adam's wife, Catherine Losey, is also an e-discovery lawyer, and I believe that's what you're referring to. It's among her skill set. She's a young associate at Ackerman Centerfit, where she also took electronic discovery in law school. In fact, she was in the same class with Adam, if I recall. Isn't that right, Adam?
That's right, and she tolerated me and still got married to me. It's surprising.
This sounds like a whole separate show. This could be interesting. Anyway, well, Adam, what was it like considering eDiscovery once you went to law school, or was this ingrained into you early on being in this family? And also, any advice that you can give Chelsea?
Sure. Well, I was lucky in that I kind of always grew up with an affinity for technology, and I had a dad that kind of ingrained that technology affinity into me. He actually designed a little computer program for me when I was a kid that would make faces. You know, you could do very basic programming things on like a TI computer that was basically a giant version of the calculator I used in high school. But I had, you know, a good connection with technology that kind of led to me going into this area of law, because as I think you'll probably touch on later, most lawyers just hate technology and really don't want to deal with it in a lot of ways. So I think if you like it, it's kind of a natural area of law for you to get into. And I guess to Chelsea, if you enjoy this and it's something that you like, then certainly there's a lot of people that don't like it. So it's a good career path if it's something you enjoy.
Interesting. Well, now let's get Chelsea involved and let's talk about the surveys. So first of all, Chelsea, why did you decide to tackle such an exciting topic when the rest of your class was surveying restaurants, vitamins, and other more mainstream topics?
Well, originally I was in a group with three of my friends doing a project on the company Vitamix, but after telling my dad about the project, he had asked if it was too late to do another topic. So I decided to do how litigators and law firm administrators could improve review, because it was a different, completely different topic than what my friends were doing. And since they weren't very interested in the topic, I ended up working alone on it.
Yeah, that's one of the more impressive things, that she did this complicated topic on her own. I guess I twisted your arm a little bit, but I thought it would be an interesting topic, and it was. You've got some really unique data that Barry and I were talking about no one else in the country has. And so why don't we first talk a little bit about some of the demographic information about the survey, Chelsea, who participated, size of law firms, their involvement in eDiscovery, number of review projects, you know, some background here.
Well, I sent out over 6,000 emails to attorneys and litigators around the country, and I got 216 respondents. Then 67% of the attorneys and litigators belong to a firm that has 101 attorneys or more. 33% belong to smaller firms of 100 attorneys or less. 70% of the attorneys have an e-discovery role in their law firm. 84% have been involved in the management of discovery involving e-discovery over the past 3 years. 53% of attorneys have been involved in more than 10 review projects. 12% have been involved with 3 or less review projects. 50% have used software for early case assessment.
Interesting. So Barry, when we looked over this data as the survey was being compiled, what was our reaction, or your reaction, about the validity of these results?
Well, it was exciting because not only is there a significant number of responses, but, you know, 218 is very high for this industry, and it includes, you know, people with actual experience, folks that are, you know, more sophisticated, you know, e-discovery professionals. And one of the questions we get asked all the time is, you know, what are the Am Law, you know, 100 or 200 firms doing? There's definitely an attitude within this industry where people want to know what are the big firms doing, and then they'll tend to copy that. So the fact that the data here has a lot of, you know, large firms and gets into the trends of what they're doing means that the data is going to be really valuable and you know, tell people or at least give them a good snapshot of what, you know, the practice of eDiscovery is looking like right now.
So when you first completed the survey, Chelsea, there was one question that Barry and I immediately looked at and went, wow. What was the first highlight that you drew from the survey?
That only 50% have used software for early case assessment.
Yeah, with all the literature we saw a few years ago on this, that sort of amazed me. So Ralph, let's get you chiming in on this, and Barry, if you want to add something. This was sort of an amazing result. Are you surprised at how low or how high this number is? I mean, what does it tell us about lawyers and technology?
Well, you know, I've spent my life in lawyers and law firms, so I know the profession pretty well. And I actually think the only thing that is maybe slightly distorted are the answers about the usage, because, you know, it's within the firm, okay, they've used it, but how often do they use it, and is it a regular part of their practice? And I think the numbers are actually much lower. I mean, particularly the business about how many people, how many firms have e-discovery practitioners. And I think that's grossly inflated, because in my experience, most firms do not have full-time e-discovery specialists. I only know of a couple of dozen, maybe. And so there's a difference in quality that's hard to measure in a statistical reference like this. But I think the reality is this is still a very young field, and there's still a lot of room for people to come in and develop skill sets. Because in most firms today, even large firms, there are not people that really are competent in e-discovery, in all aspects of e-discovery. In most firms, basically, it's a subject that people dabble in, where they may do other areas of law. They may be professional, I don't know, construction lawyers or patent lawyers or trial lawyers, and then occasionally they dabble in e-discovery. So the fact that there's only 50% that are using ECA tools doesn't surprise me one bit, because I still think we're in the very early stages of electronic discovery as a specialty area of the law, which I think due to its complexity, it needs to become.
And Barry, do you have any reaction to this?
Yeah, I would agree in the sense that it points to that this is the early phases in the e-discovery sort of maturity curve. Although I would say I was somewhat surprised at how low the number was, which I think just points to the fact that most of the folks that we're working with are either evaluating or working with some of these tools. So I think what I took away from it is a reminder of, one, that it's very early days still, and two, that this market, if you look at it from a competitive standpoint, is still very wide open. Meaning that, you know, there's a lot of technology adoption still yet to happen.
And sort of to round out ECA, we did see later, Barry, in the survey, some results about lawyer satisfaction with ECA software. And, you know, what did we see there that was interesting? Because there's a 50% that's doing this, you know? You know, there were some nuggets.
Yeah, I think, you know, what you see is that, you know, the larger law firms, because they're, you know, they're indicating that they're using this more, tend to, you know, to report more issues, ones that even the smaller firms may not be aware of. So there were issues like, you know, management and quality. So because they're doing it, they're going to run into the fact that, hey, you know, I need to, you know, make sure that I don't, you know, miss anything here, and that, you know, the quality of the review is there. So, you know, what we're seeing is that, you know, the challenges are sort of around, you know, the relationship sometimes between the law firm, you know, and the software vendors, which I found very interesting.
Yeah, and I also thought it was interesting that the ones that are using it seem to be expanding their use. I mean, it's either you can look at it as like the glass is half full or half empty, but, you know, the people that are getting it seem to be getting it. Adam, these results for ECA show that the attorneys who use ECA seem to value the involvement in the case, and maybe you can offer a guess on why you think lawyers are not trying the ECA in larger numbers and why the ones that do seem to be finding it useful.
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to the earlier point where I think most lawyers view new technology like the bubonic plague. You know, they don't want to get exposed to it. They don't really want to take the time to use it. And what's a big impediment a lot of times is they don't want a client to be a guinea pig for a new technology, and they don't have time to kind of kick the tires off the clock with it. So I think there's always going to be a reluctance to adopt any new technology or new approach at all, based on just the, hey, you know, if we've been going along so far without using this, why try and use it now? I think it's good that market conditions and the quality of the technology and what's out there has kind of made people jump off that. But the reason I think people that use it find it useful is the same reason with any other technology as well. I've found once you get somebody over that initial hump of learning, you know, what something is, how to apply it, and how it can help them, the same people that are really resistant to learning to use it suddenly become, you know, your greatest advocates and really like the technology. So I think it's pretty generally a rule that lawyers don't like to learn new technologies and try new things, with the exception of the people on this podcast and some others. But once people learn how to use things and learn how much time it can save them and how it can increase the quality of what you do, again, those people really use it and become advocates for it. And the real challenge is just getting over that hump.
Yeah, I know. I'm not going to mention, you never mention names on the show, but I know of several companies that have made large purchases in the ECA systems, and they're still in the box. And I think on this Christmas day, we should, or day after Christmas, just talk about people opening up their presents and using them, because that's the survey seems to indicate people do like these tools once they're using them. But so let's go into another topic here, Chelsea, and this was a really interesting one. You asked a general question about first pass review in the survey and how law firms believe they can improve first pass review. What were your findings there?
The findings were out of communication, project management, and technology. The mean scores of technology were the highest to improve quality, economics, and speed.
So the lawyers are embracing technology here as being the answer, although what we found with ECA was sort of interesting there. So, Ralph, given these results, let's weave a little predictive coding in here. Why do you believe the adoption of predictive coding is occurring so slowly? Do you see some comparisons to ECA?
Well, it's like the problem of the introduction originally of VCRs and why today people that have the old VCR still have the blinking time. In that there was very little done in education. They just sold the VCRs, mass quantities, with these indecipherable instruction booklets, and nobody read them and understood them. And so nobody really knew how to properly use the VCRs. And so, you know, to this day, the clock blinks, and nobody really gets it except a few technophiles that took the additional time necessary to really figure out how to use the VCRs. It was a new technology, and this goes way back. But it's the same thing with the introduction of this new technology of predictive coding. It's not being rolled out properly with proper education and explanation by any of the vendors. And I'm harping on all of them right now. They need to show the consumer how to use it, and they need to do more than just here it is, and they need to do more than project management. And so this is, I think, an educational challenge to the whole industry to do more than just sell software and give them the presents. You have to be there with them, like a good dad, and show the child how this new toy works and play with them and teach them how to use the present. When you do that, then they're going to open up the present, they're going to use it, and they're going to love it. But without that, it's going to sit like an empty box and, you know, be an embarrassment to somebody, or maybe only one or two people in the firm use it. So that's the big challenge we have. And I know you're working hard with these podcasts and all the efforts you do, and Adam is doing it now to try and make it this information on how to use these new toys more available.
And Barry and I may have some advice on this, too, coming out soon. But, Barry, were you going to say something there? Or is that Adam?
Oh, this is Adam. It's part of it, too. The challenge is, you know, for folks that really don't follow it, every week or every month you'll see a new vendor come out with a new technology that they say, you know, this is the new best predictive coding technology-assisted review, computer-assisted review tool out there. And for folks that kind of follow it, because I deal with a lot of folks that haven't drank the eDiscovery Kool-Aid like we all have, and kind of hear bits and pieces, and they read a journal article or a Times article here or there. And part of the frustration from a lot of those folks is, you know, they say, oh, gosh, well, if there's a new tool coming out every month, why should we learn how to use this one tool? And, you know, if there's a new tool that's come out that we want to use, you know, we don't want to use it on an actual, you know, live case where it's never been used before. So we want to try it out on a big document set and kind of kick the tires. And that can be a really lengthy process. If you are trying something out off the clock and you're spending, you know, a couple hundred hours testing out a new technology, that's a pretty big time investment for a lawyer that a lot of people are hesitant to make, which again, I think is kind of a problem in getting it introduced to big law firms.
Yeah, it could be 5 to 10% of your year billable time trying to figure out a tool for an individual lawyer.
And the alternative is, you know, trying it for the first time on a case. And as anybody who's tried a new technology out knows, as you use something, you learn about it, you learn quirks. You know, when you talk about document management and document review in a few minutes, you learn things. You know, you learn, gosh, maybe it's not a good idea to have an issue tag where you could easily find the same thing with a keyword search. You know, you don't want document reviewers wasting time on their issue tags tagging a phrase in a set of keyword searchable documents if you can just type it in and get it with a keyword search. So you learn things like that, and I think it's kind of important to understand the technology before you actually apply it in the field.
No, that's true. You don't want to lose your job over a bad decision, too.
Right,
so.
Exactly.
Anyway, so Chelsea, you next focused on how large law firms greater than 100 lawyers train to do better reviews versus the less than 100 attorney law firms or the smaller law firms. Did you see anything interesting here?
Yes. The larger law firms were significantly more likely to use these training techniques. For example, providing a code manual, providing examples of documents for coding, testing reviewers' understanding of the training, follow-up meetings with the review team and the trial team, and this shows that larger law firms are more sophisticated because these training techniques are present in their approaches.
Yeah, there was a pretty good split in the data in terms of the adoption of these tools between those types of firms. And Adam, you've seen some document review projects in your career. Do you think at this point in time, we understand how to do review as a profession?
You know, I think that we do. I think my dad could speak to it better than I could with his experience being greater than mine. But with my limited experience, you know, I would say that the big hurdle is I think lawyers tend to really overestimate how good human beings are at doing things and tend to underestimate how you can get two very good lawyers that are both arguably right making different calls on a large number of the same documents. And I know there's that great technology-assisted review article in the Virginia Law Review or the Virginia Technology Law Review that has a lot of good statistics on it. But, you know, I still think that a human being is not, you know, a large collection, I'm sorry, you know, 100, 200 human beings looking at things is not as good as taking one or two experts and having them use technology to review the whole set, which I think my dad would probably agree with me on.
Well, yeah, this is Ralph, the other dad. A lot of dads here. This is conversation so good. But I've seen these training manuals, and these are training manuals for yesterday's technology, for teaching contract reviewers how to review documents. I mean, that is so antiquated. I mean, that's like, yeah, they have manuals, but for what? How to start a Model T and drive an old-timey car? So the fact that they have this training doesn't really show anything. It's you got to evaluate the quality. And they're training for yesterday's technology. They're training for old-fashioned, out-of-date methods. And, you know, there's very few that are actually training predictive coding. I mean, I've been trying to do that in my firm for almost 9 months now, and I'll tell you, it's a challenge to train predictive coding. And
I think there's very
few firms out there that are actually working on the training manual for today's technology. These guys are just polishing up outdated technology, and it's obsolete by the time it's done.
Well, I've given firm-wide training. I can say I have the same reaction. It's hard. A couple people seem to get it in the audience, but you look at a lot of blank stares of people scratching their head, you know, trying to get their mind around the fact that what's the box doing? How am I comfortable? They're just not comfortable. The other thing that I saw in the data, you know, was a lot of those approaches are passive. Building a coding manual, that's passive. Showing some examples, that's passive. Weekly meetings or monthly meetings or whatever your feedback, that's active. testing, that's active. But a lot of time lawyers seem to expect that the lawyers are going to get. If you give them the information, they will go do a good job. And I think that's one thing the data shows. What we expect and what happens in reality when we throw lots of people at a project seldom match. So, but anyway, the next area, Ralph, and this question is definitely for you, is one of our managed review questions that Chelsea put together asked law firms what challenges they find with first pass review vendors. And we compared the law firms of 1 to 100 attorneys, the smaller firms, with the larger firms. And Chelsea, maybe you can share the results, and then Ralph, I think you might have some comments on this, since I know you've been a leader in advocating outsourcing the vendors, and it makes sense for law firms. So go ahead, Chelsea.
For first-pass review vendors and their challenges with outsourcing?
Yep.
Larger law firms were significantly more likely to have management issues, quality issues, and other issues with software vendors, which showed maybe potential clashes with their software vendors and law firms.
Yeah, they were definitely more active in taking their vendors to task for not doing a good enough job or, you know, doing good enough quality versus the smaller firms that were partnering, it seemed, or relying on their vendor.
And then some other issues that they had listed were technical, delivery deadline, production format.
So, Ralph, do you have any reaction to the larger firms having more, headbutting or trying to take an active leadership role questioning their vendor on what they're doing versus the smaller firms that were basically saying, hey, they're doing a great job?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is the smaller firms haven't got a clue. The people they assign to work with the vendors don't know. They don't know that they're being delivered mediocre product. The more sophisticated firms know, and naturally they're going to demand better. And I'm a difficult customer myself. You can ask my vendors. You know, I'm not easy to deal with. I want a perfection. I know it's impossible, and I want mistakes fixed. I want them fixed fast. And you can't BS me. Don't even try. But the reality is most vendors can BS their customers, and shame on them. They shouldn't be doing it, but they've been getting away with it for years because the lawyers are so clueless. You know, they didn't grow up on computers. They don't like technology, and they typically don't like technology people either, to be honest with you. And so there's a love-hate relationship. But that's really that's the past. I think as the more sophisticated consumer, you know, the next stage from that is the firms used to say, okay, so we have to have our own little company where we do the processing ourselves. We do all of these non-legal tasks ourselves because the vendors aren't good enough. And they built up their own little companies. They weren't doing legal services. They were doing non-legal services. And the justification was, that's the only way we can get it done right. And I think that justification, though, is also no longer true, because there's just no way that a law firm can run a non-legal business like an e-discovery business as well as a top-rate professional company that only does that. I mean, what law firms do well is render legal services. I've never seen a law firm that really is up to par with the top vendors in delivering non-legal services.
And this is, Adam, on a positive note, too. I've been surprised how some vendors, and, you know, I won't say which ones are really good and which ones are really bad about this, but some vendors are really just wonderful about working with you to even change what they offer custom for you. You know, there's one vendor that has a tool that I really like that the one deficiency in it is it really didn't have an OCR capability. And they said, oh, yeah, you know, we can work that in and fix that in and give you a version of it with that. And so a lot of them, I mean, the ones, and I guess this is also a way you can tell a good law firm from a bad law firm, is the ones that are really focused on client service. And I think as there's increased competition in the e-discovery vendor space, I think that's going to be more and more important, in that, you know, the vendors that really check and see what you want and don't try and BS you and change their product for you when you need it, tweak it to help you out, are going to be the ones that thrive. And the ones that just kind of, you know, take or leave what we have, and they're not very good at client service, I can't imagine that they're going to be here in the long run.
Barry, you have anything you want to add to this this data? I know that we talked about this area quite a bit.
Yeah, a couple points. You know, on the talking point that we were just going on, I think we're starting to see certain vendors, not necessarily technology vendors, but certain vendors that do predictive coding, for example, actually sort of being in competition with law firms. And you know, we've heard from certain vendors that they will not be transparent about their workflows with any law firm that has, you know, what they would consider to be a potentially competitive e-discovery practice. So I think, you know, that this issue is going to continue to come up as, you know, ECA and predictive coding kind of become, you know, one and the same over time. What I also found interesting in the data is when you look at how the law firms believe they can improve the first pass reviews, you know, so many of them pointed to technology as kind of the way to improve, which I think, you know, was interesting because you could interpret it as law firms believing that technology is the most lacking piece for them right now, but you could also interpret it as a belief that they think that technology is going to solve the problem when technology is not always the solution to the problem. It's obviously an integral piece, but to see that technology was rated so much higher than, say, like communication or project management, for example, the issues, the areas where law firms have a lot more control, I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, that's either passing the buck or looking and saying it's an easy button.
Well,
when
you contrast it with the fact that, say, only 50% indicated that they were using ECA software, for that many to believe that technology is where, you know, the improvement's going to come from, just seemed you know, almost naive to think that, you know, for so many people that aren't using technology, for them to believe that it's going to solve the problem or, you know, be the biggest improvement factor, I think sort of points out a little bit of naivete.
Yeah. Well, I like to look at the glasses half full as opposed to being half empty all the time, and I was somewhat encouraged that there were enough responses that seemed to be aiming in the right direction that I think you just got to shop. And if you're looking for, you know, law firms to get it, they're out there, you know, but it's clearly not across the board. You know, there's definitely some economic issues here between software vendors and manager view vendors, et cetera. Just a fascinating area to look at data and try to figure out what's going on. So, Chelsea,
well,
I think this is fantastic. Go ahead.
I just wanted to, the one thing that remark about not sharing workflow with law firms. You know, there is a clear, one of my pet peeves is to try and remind people that vendors are not lawyers. And even though they may be licensed to practice law, they are not practicing law. So there is no, you know, only law firms can render legal advice and determine reasonability, for instance, of review. A vendor cannot make a legal opinion like that. And these lines have gotten blurred, and you know, that's the problem. Law firms have started doing businesses, and businesses have started rendering legal services. And so that's got to stop, and I think that's part of the problem that we have with lawyers adopting technology is that this line has gotten blurred terribly to the point that both sides, I think, are harming themselves.
I think there's a
want you to sign that 26G certification. I'm not going to tell you why you should be comfortable, though.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there's a DC ethics opinion on that, too. This is Adam. Something about e-discovery vendors and the practice of law and kind of where you draw the line. I don't think it has a definitive, clear answer, but I think it's out there.
This is a war.
Well, we're getting the solution in the cost award cases under 26 U.S.C. 18, where it talks about what is a cost award that's not a legal service. So we now have case law guidance. Plus, it's pretty clear when you're giving legal advice and when you're not. And the reason that vendors have filled the gap and have been giving legal advice for years is that there weren't lawyers capable of doing it. And when they got good enough, the vendors would go and hire them. And so that's part of the problem, I think, in this whole adoption of technology. They think technology is the answer. It is, but only if you know how to use it. And by you, I mean you, the lawyer. Don't delegate your legal work to vendors. You've got to step up to the plate, learn how to do it. It takes an investment, but this is an investment that'll pay for the rest of your career and will help you advance. So it's something I'm trying to encourage everybody. I know we're all singing to the choir on this with each other, but take the time to learn this technology. It will serve you well.
So we're here at the end of the survey, and I'm going to ask each of the guests here, what issue do you see as the biggest issue in the e-discovery field going into 2013 from 2012? And then, Chelsea, I'm going to ask you what you're going to do with the survey next semester. So why don't we start with Ralph, then Adam, then Barry.
The biggest challenge for the upcoming year? Well, I think it's the same fundamental challenge of education. So I'll repeat myself a little bit. But now we're going to move on to education of really what is predictive coding. How does it work? I know that's what I'm focused on. I wrote a almost 50,000 word description of actually doing an e-discovery review project using predictive coding. That might be an exercise in boredom. I tried to keep it interesting. I found out things like the computer doesn't understand references to God. There's all kinds of little things that to me are interesting. So, you know, I'm taking my time as a writer to demystify it and show how a lawyer uses it. I'm actually going to, one of my projects is to make a video showing how it's used. I want to explain to lawyers that this is something they can do and that they must do. And so I think education and focusing in on education on technology, same old on one level, but we're going to, you know, try and now focus on the predictive coding technology and for once really explain it well. So that's what I think a big challenge going forward.
Adam?
Well, I agree with that answer, but I'll do a different one for variety's sake. And this is a substantive legal issue that I grapple with all the time. I've had a number of motions for protective order on both sides of the fence on non-party subpoenas. And under pretty much every state's rules and under the federal rules, a big issue that pops up a lot is, okay, when is discovery becoming unduly burdensome, you know? Is it when I spend $50,000? Is it when I spend $100,000? Is it when I spend $1 million? And it's very difficult, I think, and there's a sparsity of case law, as where there should be, helping you figure out where you draw that line in the sand where you say what you're asking for is overly burdensome. And I think that will be a big challenge this upcoming year and in future years, frankly, and trying to get a grasp on when you blow the whistle on when you're being asked to do too much. And I think the judiciary is probably grappling with that on a case-to-case basis, as they should. But it's a very, very difficult issue that I think is a big substantive legal challenge for every discovery practitioner.
Okay, and Barry?
Well, those are both good answers. So let me put a little variation on it in the sense that I agree that this year is all about sort of taking predictive coding down from 10,000-foot level to, you know, 100 feet and focusing in on. I think the challenges are going to be everyone sort of understanding what their roles and responsibilities are within it. And by that I mean, you know, the lawyers who are doing predictive coding for review and trying to manage review costs. But then we've also got the information governance teams at corporations who are looking at taking predictive coding and moving it upstream. And I think there'll be a lot of hype around that. So I think finding your role, whether you're an information management or e-discovery professional, and understanding how you can use technology and processes to do your job in 2013 and differentiating that from the hype, right? Because the vendors have already almost abandoned predictive coding for review and are jumping on it for, you know, proactive information governance. So understanding your roles and responsibilities within that framework and then being able to actually apply it to your job, I think, is the big challenge in 2013.
Yeah, I'm going to throw myself sort of into the weeds on that one. I agree with what everyone's saying, and I'm going to try to tie them together a little bit. I think that in addition to vendor-neutral education and how do you actually do this, What are you actually throwing into the tool? And is there a way to bring some common sense and intelligence into how much you process and throw into the tool and spit out quickly? This is where we see fire. This is where the case most likely is. Here's some data. Iteratively, do we have to go deeper? Because these tools work very well on richer data sets, and they're quick. And there's some ways here to deal with the over-collection, over-preservation issues, which Microsoft raised last year in their discussions of the Rules Committee, and which you know, came out in Pippin's versus KPMG with, you know, we don't want to go this far, and then they got slammed. Because I don't think there were enough arguments in that case with data on why we don't want to do here, and you know, and perhaps it wasn't preservation is a different requirement than actually processing and throwing data through. But I think there's a lot in here that we need to be doing, some great ideas that I think all connect together. So it's going to be a fun 2013, no doubt. Chelsea, this was great work here. What are you going to do with this research going forward?
Well, actually, next semester I am taking a continuation of the class called Marketing Management, and the teacher encourages and picks the top projects to continue on researching with, and she actually told me at the end of the semester that she wanted me to continue with this project in a group, so I will be continuing researching about this topic.
Fantastic. Okay. I may have be able to continue molding you. This is great. This later, as you're an adult. So anyway, well, thank you, everyone. I want to thank Ralph, Adam, Barry, and Chelsea for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. And I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed the podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com. For a complete list of our show, you can remember the show and website phonetically. It sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes, learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.
Cool.